series was called The Emergence of Rabbinic Judaism. And in many ways, what we're going to discuss today is the essence of Rabbinic Judaism, or the basic premise upon which Rabbinic Judaism is based or is founded. That is the idea of oral law. Now, oral law is part of a larger, umbrella, which we would often call oral tradition. And when I say oral tradition, I mean everything that will be transmitted from generation to generation and that is not in the written Bible. Oral tradition can then be subdivided into the legal aspect, which in Hebrew we call halakha, or the legal issues of oral tradition, or Judaism in general, and agada. Now, if halakha in Hebrew means the legal elements, how do we define agada?
Illegal.
You say illegal, right, very good. There are many illegal elements in agada, or extra-legal, or paralegal, and non-legal, and right. But it's a lot more than that. When I use the word agada in Hebrew today, what do people hear? If you had to translate, what would you translate? I know what you would say. I know what most Hebrew speakers would say. If they had to choose one English, yes?
Legend.
Legend. They would say legend. But legend is not... You wouldn't say, I'm sorry, I take it back. They said legend.
It's a makeup story on the basis of something.
Makeup story. Okay, it's not a legend, it's a makeup story. But you know, the fact is, it need not even be a story.
Based on something.
Nobody says anything without basing it on something. The fact is, to define the word agada is almost impossible. And the only definition that we ultimately are comfortable with is agada is everything that isn't halakha. And this is a definition that goes back to the 10th, 11th century already. And it is still the best one. In other words, everything that is not of a legal nature, and it could be stories about a rabbi talking to a rabbi, it could be stories about a rabbi talking to an angel, it could be stories about God talking to an angel, it could be anything, a description of a miracle that happened or didn't happen, right? Anything that is not what we would call legal. And so today, here in class today, we're not going to talk about Agada, much of which I know that you did with Avigdor Shinan 2 years ago, because he is the specialist in Midrash and in Agadic material. What I want to talk about today is the aspect of oral law. Now, when I say oral law, I have to define what I mean. And people tend to make mistakes because oral law means different things to different people. And I say people meaning not necessarily us today, but what it meant in antiquity. The Greeks, for instance, had a phrase, and Jews were aware of this phrase. They would talk about something called agraphos nomos. There is one Greek person here, one Greek reader here, a few of you, yes. What does that mean?
Something that's not, agraphos means something that's not written.
Excellent. Agraphos, simply non-written, right? And nomos is law, the unwritten law. But when the Greeks said the unwritten law, they did not mean the oral law. What they meant was something else. They meant the natural law. In other words, that there are two systems of legal requirements or that we all assume. One, we assume because this is the natural law of the world. In other words, laws that were not necessarily legislated at all, but are simply the result of nature. In other words, one could arrive at these laws without having been told of them by anyone, because they are the basis for natural existence. And as opposed to agraphos nomos, then there are the legislated laws. But for us, the legislated laws are both the written and the oral. So agraphos nomos means something else. But there's another aspect of unwritten law that we're not talking about today. And that is, when you read the Bible, it's clear that even before the Torah appears, the Torah assumes that you have access to laws or practices, and it doesn't even elaborate those practices because it assumes you know them. For instance, we just read, in fact, no, we're going to read it No, we just read last week, right? In Mishpatim, do you remember the very beginning of the portion where if a man sells his daughter to be a maidservant to someone else, and that someone else can either marry her or he can give her to his son. And then the book of Exodus 21:9 says, if a man sells his daughter as a maidservant and the master chooses, meaning the person who receives that woman, not to marry her and instead designated her for his son, the Torah says, he shall deal with her kimishpat habanot, according to the rights of young women. What are the rights of young women?
You don't know.
You don't know, but it is assumed already in the Bible that there were, right, certain known rights of young women, and people would know what they were about. You have many examples like this in the Torah. But that's not the oral law that we're talking about either, meaning the pre-Sinaitic oral law. That's not what we're talking about. We are talking here about the assumption, and this is, I want to stress this word, the assumption that the rabbis had that the written Torah at Sinai must, by its very nature, be accompanied with some sort of elaboration, with some sort of explication. And the reasons for this are manifold, as we will see in a few minutes. First of all, there is a rational reason for this, and that is every law, by nature, every law requires some explanation. Because as precise as you will be in formulating it, the formulation itself is limited to what is said in the formulation. But of course, we know from life that what? An event might take place a day after the legislation or 100 years after the legislation that would be slightly different from what is stated in the legislation itself. One of the conditions might be slightly different. One of the elements that make up the issue might be different. And so every legal code, not just the Torah, every legal code has its explanation. When you read the Bible, and we'll see this in a few minutes, it is clear that the written text is undoable, right? Cannot be applied unless you have some explication. I'll give you the simplest example. The Ten Commandments say you should not work on Shabbat. That on the Sabbath you should not work. There's only one thing missing. What is work? A little fact, right? Go define work. One person will say that work means what? Working up a sweat, right? That you can't do physical exertion. Another person might say, no. Work means something that achieves a purpose. In other words, if I simply take this chair and move it back and forth for no purpose, that's not work. That's maybe it's exercise. Maybe it's stupidity, but that's not work. When we say I'm going to work in the morning, it means that I'm going with a purpose. I want to achieve something. I want to accomplish something. So you might then explain that when it says don't work, it means don't do something that is planned, that has a purpose, that has a meaning. I can give you an example, for instance. The rabbis would say, if they'll say, for instance, work might include writing. But what happens if I just write down letters, individual letters that don't even make up a word, right? Just play with my pen and pencil and paper. They raise the question, is that writing, or must I actually write a word? Because that includes what? A purpose to it. That has some meaning to it, right? Or does it really mean work physical? And what happens if the work itself does not require any exertion whatsoever? I could today, certainly in a modern technological world, I can achieve so much by the flip of a switch. Is that considered work? So you see how the possibilities, and we're going to see other examples of this, where they would say, if I believe, and remember, we have to work within the parameters of the system of beliefs that accompany this idea of oral tradition. Obviously, the people who develop oral tradition believe in the divinity of the written tradition. And you cannot divide the two assumptions for them, right? Because the oral tradition for them takes on meaning only if they assume that what? A, that God gave the written tradition. B, because it was God, it is unthinkable that he would have asked me to do something that I either cannot do or cannot understand. In other words, don't know what his intentions are. In other words, he would not have left me dangling without telling me what his precise intentions were, because this is a divine book. This is God's only book, right? And we have to assume that he would not have left us in doubt. It doesn't, and I always make this point, this is the only book he wrote. And we love to laugh about this at the Hebrew University and say, you know, with one book, he never would have gotten tenure at the Hebrew University. And no way, right? And not only that, there are suspicions, did he write the whole book? And, you know, the committee would have knocked this down, right? At the earliest stages of deliberation, this would not have worked. But because of this particular fact, they assumed that there must have been some oral explanation that is attached. But that's the rationale. What are the advantages of oral tradition? That's already a whole different issue. The advantages, of course, are applicability, ongoing applicability. That is to say, an oral tradition, by its very nature, is not fossilized, right? It can constantly, right, readapt itself, relate to new realities, using the oral tradition that exists. But the very orality enables one to be, I don't want to use the word flexible, because flexible suggests a particular direction, but it enables one to be much more, suggest the word for me.
Adaptable,
right? That's the best word in the end. I don't want to even use the word accommodating, because that also suggests that I'm going in a particular direction, but adaptable would probably be the best word. But there is another advantage to orality, from a totally different direction, from a social direction. What is the difference between a written text and an oral text in terms of who has access to the text?
More people have access orally than written.
I would have said just the opposite. But why did you say what you said? Please
I said
explain.
That because oral could be without, sometimes, especially in early days, it was hard to get a hold of written text, and not everybody had access to it, whereas oral would be passed on from community to community.
That's the question. All right, so I understand, I appreciate that approach. But of course, I could explain, I could suggest an opposite scenario, and that is there's no control over a text when it's written. If a book exists in the library or in some public domain, let's call it, if a book is in the public domain, anyone can access it. I mean, imagine a library today. Not all libraries, but good libraries, right? Anyone can approach it. Orality requires something else. Not just the willingness of you to access that tradition, but the willingness of the possessor of that to transmit it. And so oral tradition adds another element, and that is the element of control, the element of choice. Another word, yes, please.
Yeah, but the written tradition has the advantage of the final word. In other words, the oral tradition will not mature or will not become impact unless it can show some relationship to the written.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. Very good. I mean, I'm willing to even say that now. Oral tradition will make a point of being linked to written tradition. The only problem is, the oral tradition we said a few seconds ago will also be adaptable, will be adapting to new realities. And the question will always be, are the solutions of oral tradition always derived from the Bible itself? Or are the solutions derived in an independent way? And then the judge or rabbi does what? Goes back to the Bible and looks for some source upon which to base that solution. In other words, and we would call any derivation from the Bible, we always refer to as midrash, right? You all know this word. But we very often talk about two types of midrashim. We talk about a midrash that is a creative midrash. That is to say, a midrash. A midrash that creates law, halakha. And then we talk about midrashim that are used as what? as a tool for either explaining an existing law or, you know, what shall I say, giving a backing, giving a support system to a law that we have come up with, and we may have come up with it independently to solve a particular issue, but we know that what? If we don't back it up with the Bible, someone may not be content. And so we create a midrash, not as the source of a law, but as what? The support of a law. And so we have two different types of midrashim, and maybe I'll get back to that in a few minutes. But this issue, that orality creates a social group, whereas written text need not. Now, I can't say written text creates a caste of scribes, right? Scribes will copy the text, and in a sense, you do have a closed group. But the fact is that once the text is published, we'll use that word, once the text is translated, once the text is out there, you have no control. Whereas an oral tradition, by its very nature, creates a social group of teacher, student, and you, of course, arrive at some sort of a chain of orality. You don't imagine a chain when you think about a book. A book exists, pre-exists, and now it's going to float around. When you talk about oral tradition, you imagine this change, this link, teacher, student, and so on, going back, well, the rabbis would say, as far back as Moses. And so their basic premise was that Moses, the great legislator, or if you wish, the great scribe of legislation, if coming down from Sinai told the people, this is what you must do, this must have included more than the written text of the Bible, because the written text of the Bible is simply impossible to do without an explanation. In other words, that's the basic premise. Now, of course, here we can be more or less, I hate the word fundamentalist, right? Does the idea of oral tradition suggest that Moses came down with 20 volumes of Babylonian Talmud, 10 in there? These are rather heavy volumes, right? And he's going all the way down, and he hasn't eaten for 40 days either, right? This is no mean task, right? Is he coming down the mountain with 20 volumes of Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud? You and I may say, no, that doesn't make sense at all. Other people would say, yes, because everything that a student in the future is liable to say was issued to Moses at Sinai. And there is a statement like that in the Talmud. Now, of course, when they make that statement, what do they want to say? And here we have to be a little more sophisticated than some people are. We can't say that Moses heard everything. But we will see in a minute that the rabbis never make that claim. The rabbis themselves are sufficiently, right, sophisticated and wise to realize not only the impossibility of that, but that it's almost an unwise statement. You don't gain anything by saying it. The rabbis will say in a number of places, and the best example, of course, is the famous Agadah of Moses going to the academy of Rabbi Akiva. Now, if everything that a student in the future is liable to say was issued to Moses, what must I assume? That when Moses sits in the back row of Akiva's academy, he understands everything. Mm-hmm. But then we are told by these same rabbis that he's sitting in the back row and he doesn't understand what they're talking about. How can that be? Wasn't he given everything? In other words, whoever told that story realizes that there's a developmental process. We have other sources that go even further to claim that Moses could not have known why, because the decision hasn't been taken yet. And it's only on the basis of decisions that oral tradition accrues and becomes more precise and expanded to deal with more and more things. We're going to see, actually we saw in this course already, that oral tradition was used by the rabbis for another purpose. And this was very important in this course, it was in this room, but it was another group of people. We didn't deal here with Christianity, did we?
No.
Ah, okay. We're going to see that there's something else involved here with the importance of oral tradition. I don't even want to get ahead of myself. So I didn't say a word, right? If I could hypnotize you, I would hypnotize you to forget the last two sentences that just issued forth from my mouth. Now, one thing I want to make clear. Today we know that oral tradition precedes the appearance of rabbinic Judaism. The idea of oral tradition was not invented by the rabbis. It already exists during the temple period, the second temple period, and we keep on saying that rabbinic Judaism only really begins to take off in the after the destruction of the second temple. We know this, that it pre-existed, because Josephus tells us about it. Now here you could quibble with me and say, well, Josephus himself was writing after the destruction. Maybe he is anachronistically taking the reality of post-temple Judaism and pushing it back to the second temple period. But I have evidence today that you cannot argue against, that there is oral tradition already in the second temple period. And this is from the writings at Qumran. Because the Qumran writings we can date, and we can date scientifically. Once we used to use carbon-14, which was a system of dating anything that once had an organic life to it and was cut off. In other words, if you're writing on parchment and parchment once grew, we can actually date how old that parchment is or something like that. Today we have even more sophisticated systems of dating the Qumranic texts. We know that they date back to the 2nd century BC, in certain cases 3rd century BCE. And these Qumranic texts make it clear that already the idea of oral tradition exists. Not only that, from a text that was published just a few years ago, we know that rabbinic tradition, in a number of cases, preceded the rabbis by hundreds of years and already existed in the Second Temple period by the Pharisees. And this is a major discovery of a few years ago. If you ever get Larry Schiffman to come out here, you can get him to talk about this. This is a text called MMT. This is short for a Hebrew phrase. MMT in Hebrew is Miktzat Ma'aseh HaTorah, some small words of Torah, right? Or a portion of the words of Torah. And what is it? It is a letter written by one of the founders of the Qumranic sect, one of the heads of the Qumranic sect. This is hundreds of years before the destruction, to the leaders of Jerusalem, where he, the leader of Qumran, argues with them about their religious behavior in the temple and in Jerusalem, about their legal behavior, how they practice certain things, how they practice laws of purity and impurity and some other things. And he tells them constantly, you people do it this way, but we know it should be done otherwise. This is the way we think it should be done. And sure enough, all the things, or a whole list of things, where he says, you people in Jerusalem are doing it this way. When we open up the Mishnah, which is the standard rabbinic text of oral law, what do we find? That all of those systems appear in the Mishnah. In other words, we can take the book of Mishnah that was written or edited 150 years after the destruction and find that what? That many of these laws in the Mishnah are already discussed by the leader of Qumran 300 years earlier, and even more than 300. This is important proof that what? That the idea of oral tradition pre-exists rabbinic ideology. In other words, the ideology is a very ancient one. How far back it goes, nobody can know. But it is clear that already in the Bible, and I know I'm going a little far out, already in the Bible we can show that later biblical books have oral traditions about earlier biblical books and have interpretations of oral earlier books. There is a brilliant work, a massive work, by a professor of the University of Chicago. His name is Fishbane, and he wrote probably the definitive text on biblical interpretation of the Bible. And so what we see here already is what? That from the moment the Bible was issued, it required interpretation. These interpretations appear in the later books of the Bible itself and then orally. Let's look at the first source that you have in front of you, because this is probably the first attestation systematically to the existence of oral tradition. And this is in the writings of Josephus, our famous historian, who wrote the history of the Jewish people, his antiquities, and he mentions this oral tradition a number of places. But let's read just this. To put this into certain perspective. Can I ask somebody to read this text? Please. Anyone? Someone.
Josephus' Antiquities. For the present, I wish merely to explain that the Pharisees had passed on to the people
certain regulations handed down by former generations and not recorded in the laws of Moses.
Okay, so first of all, he says, not everything was recorded in the laws of Moses, but the Pharisees, one of these sects that existed in the Second Temple period, and clearly the forerunners of the rabbis, they are the forerunners, they are the spiritual antecedents of the rabbis, even though we always quibble what the exact relationship is between Second Temple Pharisees and post-temple rabbis, but the fact is that they are the forerunners. They passed on laws that are not recorded in the laws of Moses. For which reason? Continue, please.
For which reason they are rejected by the Sadducean group.
Stop. There's another group called Sadducees in the Second Temple period. They do not accept what?
The
Sadducees. They do not accept, no, but in terms of the legal aspect, what don't they accept? What does he say here? They don't accept the extra tradition, right? What do they believe only in? Torah. Wait a minute. They're all written. So how do they answer all those questions that I opened up our session with today? How do they know what work means? How? It is impossible not to have a tradition. How do they do it? Ah, yafeh. You said, somebody said their own tradition. Wait a minute. So it's not out of principle that they don't believe in anything outside of the Bible. It's only that they don't like what the Pharisees are saying. Aha, that's interesting. That's somewhat similar to what will happen in the early Middle Ages when we encounter another group that is opposed to Rabbinic Judaism. They are the Karaites, and I'm sure many of you have heard of them. They appear only when we arrive in the 7th and 8th centuries. And they also, we always like to think that who are the Karaites? They are the biblical fundamentalists, only the Bible. Until you read the books of the Karaites, and what do you realize? Boy, did they have a tradition that would not be embarrassed in comparison with the rabbinic tradition. They had a lot of extra biblical tradition. What they argued was with the rabbis, who gave you the authority? Who says your authority is better to explain the Bible, to interpret? But the Sadducees had another way of doing this. Sadducees do come from another ideological perspective that sees something else. And now let's read a little further. They hold that only those regulations should be considered valid that were written down in Scripture. But you'll notice that the two words in Scripture are in parentheses. What is the difference if those two words are there or aren't there? It's a major difference. If I say they hold that only those regulations should be considered valid that were written down in Scripture, then I have a problem. How do they explain what was written in Scripture? How do they explain what work is on Shabbat? But if you take away those two words in Scripture, and I can tell you, you don't have to take them away by force, they are not in the original Greek. And this was put in by later translators. They claim that only regulations should be considered valid that were written down, period. In other words, as you said correctly, they probably had their own tradition. How did they legislate it? How did they render it binding? By doing what? Writing it, inscribing. We know that the Sadducees had other books. And these books are referred to in Midrash. And what was the problem? They wrote them down. What would the rabbis have said? You can't write it down because everything that isn't in the Bible must be preserved how? Orally. Whereas the Sadducees say, no, they must be written. And this is an interesting perspective. Because the fact is that in the ancient world, for many societies, what rendered a law binding? What rendered legislature operative? It's inscription, it's writing down, it's setting up in a temple. And I don't know how many of you know, but I'm sure some of you do, what is the Hebrew word for law? Very good. Right? Let's write it down like this. Chum. But what other word comes from the very same root as chok? Hakak. What does this word mean?
Legislator.
Ah, you're right. But what else does it mean? Lachkok.
To legislate.
Besides legislate. To inscribe. To inscribe in stone. So think about it. The same root in biblical Hebrew means to inscribe in stone and to legislate. And so you see where the Sadducees are coming from. Yes, you can have another tradition, but to make that tradition binding, what must you do? It has to be written down. Whereas the Pharisees say, no, we want anything that is not in the Bible to be oral. And of course, clearly this is a social issue. Once it's oral, then those people who possess the oral tradition assume a position of power, of control, and that's us, right? And so you can immediately imagine the tensions. Yes, you had a question. I can't say why. You know, that's an unfair question. It's a good question, but it's unfair to me. In other words, I don't know. I'm not a, it's hard to say one of the practical realities was that those people who possessed oral tradition and had a following assumed a position of social, right, authority. Is that the origin of the idea of oral tradition? None of us can prove. There's no way. Yes, please.
I can't hear what?
The oral tradition, a few hundred years later, was in fact written down.
Oh, yes. Right. That will be... And now let's make... It's an excellent point. I should have even alluded to that at the beginning, but I'm glad you did. Oral tradition, ultimately, in the early Middle Ages, will become transcribed as well. Already the Talmud, in one of two places, notes they started writing down Agadah, even though Agadah was also supposed to be oral. Remember, we saw that before, that oral tradition includes this as well. Already the Talmud says that they have books of Agadah. Later on, we know the Mishnah, the Talmud, will be written and then ultimately even printed. But that's a much later phenomenon, right? Much, much later. In their time, we know that it was maintained orally. We know something else, that even if people had notes that they secretly kept, or not secretly kept, so that they could remember. And we know of such notes like that. Those notes could never be introduced into the academy as a basis for discussion. And much has been written about this in the last generation. By the way, not only among Jews who deal with this. I would say about 30 years ago this began. This was a hot topic in academia, orality, and the maintenance of oral cultures. And there's a well-known book by a fellow called Ong, O-N-G, if you want, you can look this up, where he shows that you had cultures in the Middle Ages and even early modernity who transmitted orally encyclopedias full of material. You know, these enormous epic poems that go on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of what we call today pages, right, existed in societies that had no access to writing or did not use writing, and it was passed on in an oral fashion. And we know this to be the case in many societies, and the rabbinic society as well. In fact, it's even clear from Talmudic discourse that they would not look at a book to solve a problem, other than the Torah. You have tractates. The first tractate, I wasn't going to get to this, but since you asked, and it's a good question, it's a very important question. The rabbinic tractate of Avodah Zarah that deals with idolatry says that on holidays of Gentiles, one should not have any discourse with them for 3 days before the holiday, lest that person be happy with the discourse, meaning business transactions. That person might be happy with the transaction and go off to his pagan temple and thank his particular god, so I'm causing idolatry to be worshipped. The word for the phrase in the Mishnah is lifnei eidehem shel nochrim, or shel goyim, before the eidehem. And the first question in the Talmud is that Eidehem with an Aleph or Eidehem with an Ayin? And they start quoting scriptures all over the place, and doesn't dawn on anybody to say, well, let's look at the Mishnah and see what it says. Let's open the book. Because you can't open the book. And this is very interesting. We have many examples like this where it's clear they are not working out of books. They are working in an oral environment. Now, so this is the first important point, that orality was the formal way that this tradition was maintained and then later on passed on. Now, they're very happy to make the point that Moses received this. If you look at source number 2, Moses received the law from Sinai, handed it down to Joshua, Joshua to the elders, elders to the prophets, prophets to the men of the great assembly, whoever they were, I don't want to talk about this. They said three things: be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples, make a fence around the law. When it says in the Mishnah, Moses received the law, what law is he talking about here? Written or oral?
How do you know?
Both.
Huh? What are they talking about here? No place for... It can mean both, but wait a minute. Moses, wait a minute, guys. Moses, A said to B, A got the Torah, gave it to B to C to D, and D said three things. I got news for you. None of those three things appear in the Bible. Now, if they don't appear in the Bible, what does that mean? That we're talking about an oral tradition. In other words, here you see that when they talk about the chain of tradition, they are referring to the oral aspect. And this is kind of cute. I don't know if you noticed who they left out of the list. Because we know that the written Torah, during much of the Bible period, was actually preserved by and taught by a whole other group that isn't mentioned in the text. The priests, the Kohanim. And the Bible says in many places, you go to a Kohen to learn the Torah. Right? Why do you think they left them out?
Because they were Sadducees.
Huh? Very good. Excellent. Not only Sadducees, but also Sadducees. Because the rabbis considered themselves to be what? Those taking over when the priests fall on their face in the late Second Temple period. I got news for you. It isn't only Mel Gibson that describes the priests of the late Second Temple period as being cruel, as being vicious, as being, quote, un-Jewish, as it were. The rabbis also make the same point. They are very happy to claim that what? We have succeeded a group that, in fact, has fell into disrepute because of their improper behavior. Yes?
We saw things. You mentioned the Dead Sea Scroll.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the Sadducees.
Yeah.
Do they have anything in common?
You're opening up. According to recent scholarship, if I said invite Larry Schiffman, he's a professor of Dead Sea Scrolls at NYU. He'll tell you anything you ever want to know about Dead Sea Scrolls and a lot more. He is coming. Ah, okay. Anyway, he will tell you that the Qumranic sect, in fact, were the Sadducees. That's the new theory of the last generation among many people. But it's very hard to prove definitively. But what do we see here? That the chain then going back to Moses already includes oral tradition. And I stress, though, that even though it includes oral tradition, the rabbis knew that what they were teaching, Moses may never have really heard at all. They knew they were innovating. And source number 6.
I have only one.
I gotta go. This is such an important topic that I know I can get sucked into digressions in the easiest possible way. It's so easy to do this to me. And we have to prepare for the dinner for tomorrow. Okay. But source number 6 is one of the most beautiful stories in Agadah. It really is. It is so touching. Why? Because it is so honest. Can I ask somebody to read this, please? Anyone? All right, but out loud so we hear. Rav Yehuda.
Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, when Moses ascended on high to receive the Torah, he found the Holy One, blessed be he, engaged in affixing tagim,
crown-like
flourishes to the letters.
Yeah, what is the issue here? The Torah is written with letters. And the rabbis will explain every letter of the Torah. Not one letter is superfluous. The rabbis will explain everything in the Torah. So that if God adds little squiggles on the letters, what will the rabbis do? They will explain the squiggles as well. So if God writes little squiggles on the letters, right, he's doing this so that what? The rabbis can come along hundreds of years later and why this little flourish is here, why that little flourish is there. It must mean something. Okay, because nothing's superfluous. This is God's book, right? He doesn't work, he doesn't do things, you know, For no reason. Okay, continue.
Moses said, Lord of the universe, who stays your hand?
Meaning, is there
anything lacking in the Torah that additions are necessary?
Yeah, why do you need these flourishes? Why are you adding them to the letters, right? Why not just write it all out? Okay.
He answered, there will arise a man at the end of many generations, Akiva ben Joseph by name.
This is the famous Rabbi Akiva, of course. You see, Akiva needs these little squiggles, right? Because he has so much to say, right? But he cannot say it unless he finds what? Something to derive it from. Remember what we spoke about before, the creative versus, in other words, here they're suggesting Well, it's not quite clear. Is he creating based on the flourishes, or does he simply have a lot to say, and he has to go back to the Torah and attach everything that he's saying to the Torah? But when he runs out of words, he uses the flourishes, right? Okay, continue.
Lord of the universe, said Moses, let me see him. He replied, turn around. Moses went and sat down behind...
18 rows. And 18 rows, by the way, is where the backbenchers sat. The people that don't understand too much yet, right?
Rose up a rabbi of Rabbi Akiva's disciples and listened to their discussions. Not being able to follow their arguments, he was ill at ease.
Stop! We could stop the story here. He doesn't know what they're talking about. But wasn't all of oral tradition given to Moses at Sinai? What happened? Was this just a poor day for Moses? He probably had given. I mean, we assume that after Sinai, he's been giving a lot of lectures, right? And the more lectures you give, the more tired you become, and you can't slip up. You know, it's been known to happen, right? But he doesn't understand. And so what happens? He is.
But when they came to a certain subject, and a disciple said to the master, from where do you know this?
You realize they've been pushing Akiva up against the wall. Prove this. And he said, well, there's that flourish. And prove that. Well, there's a little squiggle on that olive over there. Right. And he finally probably ran out of squiggles. Right. And how do you know this? How do you know that this is authoritative? This last halakha that you just gave us, what was his answer?
He replied, it is a law given to Moses at Sinai.
And what do you think happened when he said that? Originally, before they tell us that, how wonderful Moses felt, what was probably his gut reaction?
No, I didn't
feel this enough. I would have felt very uncomfortable, right? In other words, suddenly they're blaming me for this, right? This was given to Moses at Sinai. He probably didn't understand. But of course, he's very happy that what? That they attribute everything to him, right? So.
Such a man, and you give Torah by me? He replied, "Be quiet."
Right. It's a fantastic story, right? But it's an honest story. The honesty here is in what? That the rabbis are willing to admit that this oral tradition is nevertheless a developmental process, right? If you want to see another example of this, look at source number 7. If the Torah had been given in a fixed form, the Talmud says, the situation would have been intolerable. What does that mean? A foot could not stand. What is the meaning? What is the meaning of the phrase, the Lord spoke to Moses? What is this? The Talmud says, Moses says to God, Lord of the universe, cause me to know what the final decision is on each matter of law. Moses says, I want to know every final decision that will ever be taken in matters of law. Now, of course, this means, this is oral stuff. This is not written stuff, right? I want to know all of Jewish law to the end of days. And God says, it can't be done. Why? He replied, I can't do it. The majority must be followed. When the majority declares a thing permitted, it is permitted. When the majority declares it forbidden, it is forbidden. What does that mean?
It's democratic.
It's democratic. Law is decided by majority vote, by any court. But what else does it mean?
God doesn't make the law.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you. How do I know what the majority is going to decide? In other words, what is he suggesting? I have no control. It's in human beings' hands. So I cannot tell you, Moses, what all of Jewish law will look like 2,000 years from now, because the majority decisions haven't been taken yet. Now we have come to one of the most important elements of oral tradition. Oral tradition, according to the rabbis, is totally in the hands of its possessors, its students, its teachers. There is absolutely no contact with God. There is absolutely no further revelation. And this is the ultimate underpinning of oral tradition. It is almost antithetical to the idea of what? Revelation. There was one revelation. It was at Sinai. It has not and will not ever be repeated. And so oral tradition now means what? A constant re-examination, readapting, reapplication, and in new issues, to always applying it to new developments, to new issues. Why do you think they're so... And of course, the most beautiful story of there not being ever another God, voice issuing from God, or if there is, we'll tell God none of your business, is of course source number 8. This is, again, I really tried to choose the most important and well-known sources that deal with aspects of oral tradition. Can I ask someone else, please, to read? Yes. On that day. Well, let me. What day was this? Rabbi Eliezer.
One second.
The story before this is that Eliezer gets into a dispute with all the other sages at the academy over issues of law. Mm-hmm. Eliezer is a very tough, hard-willed, strong-willed person who is known from other sources not to back down. In fact, he seems to have been a champion of the house of Shammai sometimes. And we know that the Shammaites evince very often a very tough manner as opposed to the easygoing Hillel students, right? The good guys in rabbinic literature. So Eliezer was not willing to give up, even though he was outnumbered. Go ahead.
Rabbi Eliezer brought forward every possible argument, but they did not accept them. Said he to them, if the law agrees with me, let the stream of water prove it.
In other words, let there be a miracle that proves that I'm right. Let the water aqueduct start flowing in the wrong direction.
Whereupon the stream of water flowed backwards. They rejoined, no proof can be brought from a stream of water.
Yes, we know that water means nothing, right? Even though, I could play with this text all day. The rabbis love to say, Ein mayim ela Torah, that water is what? Torah. So you can't read proof from Torah on Torah. It's kind of a little game. Let's see what else. Okay.
Again, he urged, if the law agrees with me, let the walls of the...
I actually skipped something here. Ooh, I just noticed this because I have such a beautiful drasha. No. What else moves before the walls? There's a tree. There's a cherub tree, and he says, let this tree prove it. And the tree gets up and moves 50 yards. And they all say, but we know we can't bring proof from a tree. But of course, a tree is also... Eitz chayim hi lamachazikim va. A tree is also Torah. So it's very interesting, where he's using metaphors that come from the world of Torah, but we can't bring these miracles. Okay. Continue.
Let the walls of the schoolhouse prove it, whereupon the walls inclined to fall. But Rabbi Joshua...
I mean, showing God's will, that he's right, yes.
Rabbi Joshua rebuked them, saying, when scholars are engaged in legal dispute, what right have you to interfere?
It's nice. He calls the walls, but out.
Hence, they did not fall in honor of Rabbi Joshua, nor did they resume the upright position in honor of Rabbi Eliezer. And they are still standing thus in
I love to tell Professor Yadin, the late archaeologist, if he ever finds a wall inclined somewhere near the southern coast of Palestine... This is where the story took place, right? Okay.
Again,
I got to tell you, the story took place in the imagination of the Babylonian Talmud storyteller. And I'll tell you why. Because the same story appears in the Palestinian Talmud. Here, what does it say? The walls incline. In the Palestinian Talmud, the same story appears, but what does it say? The columns of the academy started to shake. Columns are made out of stone. Walls are made out of bricks and mud. In Babylonia, they imagined the story happening with walls of bricks and mud. In Palestine, they imagined the story happening with columns of stone. Every storyteller always tells a story based on the reality that he recognizes. And you see this here very, very nicely. Okay.
Again, he said to them, if the law agrees with me, let it be proved from heaven. Whereupon a heavenly voice cried out, why do you disagree with Rabbi Eliezer, seeing that in all matters the law agrees with him? Rabbi Joshua arose and exclaimed, it is not in heaven. What did he mean by this? Rabbi Jeremiah said that the Torah had already been given at Sinai. Therefore, we pay no attention to a heavenly voice because you, God, have long since written in the Torah at Mount Sinai. One must follow the majority.
In other words, this is fantastic. God, we're following your instructions. You told us majority rules. We're following your instructions. There is no... You told us, right... It is not in the heavens, Deuteronomy 30. That, right, there would never be another revelation. That's how they want to understand that. It's not in the heavens, although you can interpret that differently. And sure enough, Rabbi Nathan met Elijah. Some rabbis have knacks for meeting Elijah the prophet. I mean, we open up our door at the Seder for Elijah, but we rarely see him come in, right? Other rabbis meet him every other day. And Nathan was one of them. And he asks Elijah, what did the Holy One, blessed be he, do at that hour when he was what? Defeated on the battleground of Halakha by his disciples. He laughed and said, my children have defeated me. My children have defeated me. It was great. God turns into a rabbi here. But he turns into a rabbi on the losing side, which is really nice. What is the point? And this is why source number 8 complements source number 7. 7 talks about majority ruling. 8 says it's not just a matter of majority ruling. The issue is, at Sinai, God severed himself from Torah. This is the point. What is the word in Hebrew? What do we call Sinai? Matan Torah. The giving of Torah. What is a gift? A gift, a matana. And a gift, by essence, is what? What is a real gift? When the giver gives it to someone else and totally disconnects, because you never take a gift back, right? In other words, the essence of a gift is total distancing and removal from the gift. If Torah is a gift, God no longer has any control over it. No ties. Since he has no ties, he is removed. There cannot be revelation. Why are they so against revelation? You can guess. Christianity believes in revelation. And here the point is, I can tell you something. In another rabbinic story, Eliezer is arrested by the Romans on suspicion of being a Christian. And you got the natural tendencies to put two and two together. This is the same guy who is going to base himself on revelation, and elsewhere they talk about him having Christian tendencies. He, of course, denies it, and in the end, he gets out okay. He was put on trial, and he gets out of the trial okay. Through all sorts of trickery, it doesn't matter. But the point is that oral tradition now comes to become connected with the issue of Christianity. And sure enough, turn to page... wait a minute. It's got to be here. Can't be that it's not here. Ah, yeah, of course, page 1. Source number 5. Can I ask you to continue reading, please?
Yes.
Midrash, okay.
Midrash Tanchuma. Tanchuma. Rabbi Judah Bar Shalom said, when the Lord said unto Moses, write down, Moses requested that the Mishnah also be in writing.
Remember, what is Moses getting at Sinai? Not just written tradition, but oral.
So, okay, he's written 5 books. That's kind of tiring.
And then God tells him, put your pen down. From here on, everything is what? Oral. And he starts going through Mishnah, one tractate, another tractate, another tractate, Moses. Can I take notes? Can I write something down? How am I going to remember all this? Right? And I'm fasting, right? God says nothing. Not one letter. Why?
The Holy One, blessed be he, foresaw that the nations of the world would translate the Torah and read it in Greek, saying, we are Israel.
Who is that? Who says they are Israel? What do they read? The Torah. In what language?
Greek.
They read the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim, the translation of the 70. In other words, remember what we said before? A book is accessible. And that's what happened to the book, the Bible. Bible means book, Biblos, right? The book was accessible, people took it, and they claimed it's not just that we read it, we've adopted it. It's ours. And so we are Israel. So what do I have to do? I have to preclude people having access to the entirety, the totality of tradition. How can I preclude it? By not writing everything down. Look at the word they use here. We are Israel. He therefore replied to the heathen. Go ahead.
You claim to be my children, but my children are those that possess my mystery.
And mystery. You all know the word from English, mystery.
Why do you think they use the word mystery in Latin, or Greek and Latin?
Because this is the essence of Christianity as well as they knew it. Christianity believes in the dogmas of what? And in the mystical transition of the bread and the wine into what?
Into the body
and blood of Jesus. And this is called a mystery in Christianity. So what does the Midrash say? You guys think you have a mystery. We have the real mystery. What is the real mystery? Oral tradition. Because this is really secretive. Why is it really secretive? Because it's oral. You cannot get a hold of it. And so with the Midrash, and continue please to the end. And what is that? The Mishnah?
The Mishnah, verbally transmitted.
Now this is an important point. Historically, oral tradition would come to designate Jews, not Bible. Bible belongs to everyone. When you want to punish or persecute Jews in Paris in the 13th century, what do you burn? You don't burn the Bible, you burn the Talmud. Right? In other words, this is the sign of Jews, this oral tradition, which of course ultimately would be written. But these elements of legal tradition became uniquely Jewish. If you look, this issue of no revelation is stressed in many, many places. Look, for instance, at source number 10. Or 9 and 10. It is written 9. For this commandment is not in heaven. Moses said to the Israelites, lest you should say, another Moses is to arise to bring us another law from heaven. Therefore I make it known to you now that it is not in heaven. Nothing is left of it in heaven. There's no Torah, no chapters, no hidden chapters there. Everything was given. You've got to work with it. Huh? This is, or as number 10, a prophet is prohibited from introducing something new. Remember the premise for oral tradition.
You cannot understand the Bible without it. Source number 11 gives an example. I won't read it now, but I'd just like to give you the essence of it.
On Sukkot, on the Feast of Tabernacles, what do we take up? What do we wave? And what else? What are we? An etrog, right. What is an etrog? It is a? It's like a lemon. If I take a, it's a citrus. What happens if I take a lemon? Am I doing okay?
No.
No. If I take an orange?
No.
If I take, I'm going to run out of things. I'm not too good in agriculture. What is the point? If you read the scripture, what does it say? You shall take on the first day. Pre-Eitz Hadar, a citrus fruit. I don't know which one. You shall take what? It says, branches of a palm tree. Do we wave branches of a palm tree? What do we take? The heart, the lulav, which is the very middle of the palm tree. In other words, what are they saying?
If you or I were to write a book, we would leave things there. This is God's book. God will not ask me to do something and then leave me in doubt what he means. So how do I know it's an etrog and not an orange or a lemon? This I receive how? Through oral tradition.
The image is very simple. Write down pre-Eitz Hadar citrus fruit. So Moses writes it down. And then he taps him. Moses, it's an etrog. Now, remember this, it's an etrog. Moses probably said, I've never seen one in my life, right? And who knows where it went from there, right? But the point is, you're playing now on this tension, written and oral tradition. And the two will constantly supplement or complement one another. A few more words, however, about oral tradition. Oral tradition, in the end, can literally undo written tradition. What does that mean? We have laws in the Bible, but the rabbis clearly could direct these laws. And they have tremendous power, and they have tremendous intellectual power. So for instance, if I kill him, Ari, this is an example, it has nothing to do with it. It's not because it's the end of my tenure here, right? If I kill him, what happens to me according to the Bible? What is my sentence?
You die.
I die. Okay.
If I have two witnesses.
So I had to be very smart. Wait until I make sure there are two witnesses around before I kill him. Only two witnesses? It's not just only two witnesses. According to oral tradition, those two witnesses have to warn me, don't do it. And know that if you do it, you will be sentenced to death. So you realize, I'm about to kill him, but then we sit down and have a little discussion. Yeah, tell me about this so I should know, right, before I kill him, what it is that it's about. Not only must the witnesses tell him the punishment is this and this and so on and so forth, he then must reply, even though I know that the sentence is that, nevertheless, I'm going to kill him. And then I stab. Okay. As a result, look what happens with oral tradition. Even though the Bible legislates that my punishment is death, look at source number 16. A Sanhedrin which imposes the death penalty once in 7 years is called murderous because it's almost impossible that all the conditions for actually carrying out a death penalty would be there. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says once in 70 years is already a lot. Rabbi Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva say, if we were on a Sanhedrin, no one would ever be put to death. In other words, what you have is really fascinating here, the tremendous power that the rabbis saw in using this oral tradition, where they can actually overcome, as I say, written tradition. Now, this, don't think that only you have liberals and conservatives, right? We want to do away with the death penalty. And then, of course, you have the conservative radio show host. In this case, Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel says, oh, yeah, they would do away with the death penalty, so they would multiply the number of murderers in Israel. Nothing has changed here, right? Where you have the two approaches about, you know, things, but it's not just death penalty. It's so many other things that you see that oral tradition gave them a tremendous deal of power to do what they thought was right. A few last words. Yes, please, I'm sorry.
So, is it disingenuous then when the rabbis say that there really is nothing new? I mean, isn't
it? It's not disingenuous, you're right. What they're saying is, and of course you have to understand, conceptually I can say, and this is the classic, of course, it's not a contradiction, it's the we don't believe in determinism, right? We believe that we all have free will. And nevertheless, we believe in an all-knowledgeable God that knows what was and what will be. And so this seems to be, of course, a contradiction by definition. So the rabbis could say the same thing, that in essence, it is in the hands of the rabbis to constantly develop this law, but that it's almost like what? Like an embryo or something, this is a law that is constantly developing out of what was planted in that kernel that we would call oral tradition and the earliest written tradition. In other words, for us in this world, it appears to be constantly new and innovative and so on, and we have to assume that that's what it is. Ideologically, what they would claim is, this has God's sanction to it. And then you remember, and I didn't bring it here, I think, in the sources, where the Torah says, you shall listen to what they teach you and not swerve from what they teach you. Lo tasur mikol asher yomru lecha yamin usmol. You shall not swerve from what they teach you, right or left. And the Midrash says, there are different versions of this, even if what appears to you to be right is left and left is right. In other words, even if you don't understand it sometimes. In other words, they are legislating. You accept it because it's divine authority. God has given them authority, but of course, now don't ask me who chooses who has the authority and who doesn't. That's tonight's lecture on ordination. How do you become a rabbi that possesses oral tradition? That's a whole different issue. Here we're talking about the ideology of oral tradition, right? Assuming that there are recognized authorities of oral tradition, they have God's imprimatur, they have his seal of approval, but they are constantly innovating. And so the idea is that their innovation would have God's recognizance and God's seal of approval on it. It's not as complicated as all that. It's the same thing that you assume in any legislative process, where you have a constitution, and then you have judges for the next 200 years doing what? Drawing conclusions from the constitution and interpreting law. And you have a development of law, and it's an ongoing development of law. It has some foundation to it, but everybody knows that in the end, it's the interpreters who are innovating and the interpreters who may have different legal approaches. And whenever you study rabbinic tradition, you'll find that that's the case as well, that you have different rabbis who have different approaches to law and to the legal system. And that's what it's now. As a result, I really want to look at the source, and this is, any lawyer would appreciate this source, because it really goes to the heart of legal tradition. And this is, here we are on page 3. Look at source 14. Continue, please.
And why do they record the opinion of an individual along with that of the majority?
If we said that majority rules, why is it in the Mishnah that it says the halakha is so-and-so? Rabbi Akiva says otherwise. Why do I have to know minority opinions? Which, of course, is the exact same thing that the Supreme Court here issues, minority opinions. Why do I have to know minority opinion? If they took a vote, tell me what the majority says. What is the answer?
So that if a court should prefer the opinion of the individual, it may decide to rely on it.
This is fantastic. Minority opinion has legal reasoning to it also. A subsequent court in a different case might prefer the reasoning of the minority opinion in an earlier case and choose it. So what do we have here? We have an ongoing process. I have to know this is not... Oral tradition is never simply what my rabbi taught me. That's only one aspect of oral tradition. Oral tradition is also what? Applying legal principles to new realities. The legal principles are based on what I received. Applying them to new realities is legal consideration. That's exactly what a lawyer does today. That's exactly what a judge does. And as a result, I have minority opinions built into the system, and they can later on be used. Later on, the same Mishnah gives another reason for giving us a minority opinion. Let's say we're sitting, let's say this is my academy, right? And I teach the halakha, and then you get up and say, but I received another tradition from my teacher. We can tell you, if we are fortunate enough, but your tradition is a minority tradition. We know about that tradition. In other words, we preserve minority traditions so that we should know that they are minority traditions sometimes. Oral tradition ultimately became... Yes, you had a question very quickly. Yeah, one second.
I just want to ask you a question. Why... I want to jumpstart you to like the 16th century.
Go ahead.
Why did Rabbi Caro come out with the short?
Oh, okay, that's what I was getting to now.
Okay.
The last point I wanted to make is oral tradition is fluid, but every... I don't want to say now and then, that would be a mistake. At certain junctures in Jewish history, oral tradition becomes codified. In other words, they're sort of stations on a railroad track. And the big riddle for historians is what happened in the early 3rd century to cause the Mishnah to come about? Why not just continue the system for another few hundred years? But sure enough, in the early 3rd century, a rabbi, patriarch, living in Palestine, Judah the patriarch, codifies the Mishnah, organizes the Mishnah, sets up oral tradition thematically in 6 sections. There are all sorts of suggestions why he was able to do it. It could be the political situation, which had turned for the better. We know that in the early 3rd century, the very early 3rd century, Jews had relatively good relations with the Roman Empire, with one of the dynasties, the Severan dynasty. That could be a possibility. We don't know exactly why. But we encounter for the first time after the Bible, the first code is the Mishnah, which means a second version of the law. 3rd century. Another few hundred years will pass, in which the Mishnah will be discussed as a legal text and as the basis for Jewish philosophical contemplation as well, until we ultimately arrive at the Talmud. So here we're already talking about 5th to 7th centuries. And then hundreds of more years would pass. And what do we find? In the post-Talmud period, people are constantly codifying, right? We get to the 12th century, Maimonides takes all of Talmudic literature and organizes it in 14 books. So it's Caro is not the only example. In other words, Caro was following a tradition, right? Now, by the way, after Maimonides and before Caro, there was somebody else who actually wrote the book upon which Caro based his book. He's talking about the Shulchan Aruch, the very famous book. Now, you should know that the Shulchan Aruch is not Joseph Caro's best book. It's kind of something that he did in his past, in his spare time. And he actually says that he did it kind of as a textbook for students so they can review their studies every few weeks or something. And that became our Bible, right? He actually wrote a commentary to an earlier book of law, an earlier code that was known of as the 4 columns, the Arbat Turim. And this was published by a rabbi of Germany a number of years earlier. And his name was Yaakov ben Asher, doesn't matter. But these four columns sort of crystallize the four elements of Jewish law, civil law, the law of holidays and liturgical law, laws of food, right? In other words, what you have here are four, and what is the fourth one? Huh? And the laws of purity and marriage. Actually, it's marital laws. What is interesting is that one-fourth, then, of Jewish legislation deals with food, which I thought is a very interesting phenomenon as well, right? What does that say about us? But the point is, different generations use different systems for codifying. Now, you asked me about Karl. Karl comes about in a very interesting period. You know, this is already 400 years old. Right? It's in the 16th century. Why does his book catch on as the code more than all of the earlier codes? He had one thing going for him, among other things. That was the exact same century where the printing press comes around. And the printing press had a tremendous effect on distributing books. Now, it also, the press, they also printed Maimonides and they printed earlier codes. But the book that was done in that 16th century had that good fortune, and that's one of the reasons that it became immediately widespread, even though it's written, as it were, in Tzfat, right? But it takes on, as you know, the Shulchan Aruch became the basis mainly for Sephardic Jewish legislation. When it comes to Europe, a very well-known rabbi in Europe adds his comments to the Shulchan Aruch, and those comments become the basis for Ashkenazic behavior. No, that's something else. We're talking about the Ramah. This is already, I'm getting to details here. What is the point? Point is, oral tradition ultimately assumes an enormous library. But, and now I want to add one thing. The library is not comprised only of what? Codes, Mishnah, Maimonides, Shulchan Aruch. There is another major component. And this is where you see, I think, the greatness of oral tradition more than all the codes. And that is what we call responsa literature. And we are talking about what are responsa. And this is the phenomena of 1,000 years of literature, where communities or individuals, but this is the greatest mirror on Jewish history that we can imagine. Because you see what people are asking, where they're asking it, but you also see something else, how the rabbis answer. And you see different rabbis who answer in totally different ways. And you see different tendencies. You can see the more extreme element, very strict in their approach. You see the more, I don't want to use the word, but maybe forthcoming, flexible element that has a totally different approach. This is where you see oral tradition, if you ask me, really doing what it was intended to do, to constantly relate to the environment, to relate to reality. The codes are nice, right? The codes are great for legal scholars when they get the full scope of law. But the responsa literature is the lifeblood of Jewish law, of what we call oral tradition. And we have to realize these two are two components of what we call then oral tradition. I'm way over, and I want to thank you for being so well behaved. So it's not, I told my students this many times at the Hebrew University, I don't get upset when they look at their watches. When they start going like this, I get very troubled when time stops, right, completely. Thank you.